Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Seriously Risky Business, the podcast that I do with Tom Uren, the author of the Seriously Risky Business newsletter. My name, of course, is Patrick Gray. And before we get going, I'd like to say a special thank you to the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative for supporting this work, and also to our corporate sponsor, Proofpoint. Now, Tom, we're going to talk about this week's newsletter edition. It's been a few weeks since we did this podcast. You were gone for a conference, and then I think the week that you came back, I think we were just too busy to do it, really. But you've written up a few things this week. The first one is you've taken a look at the US government's concerns around TikTok. And one thing you've done really in this piece is to clarify the difference between concerns around technical device access, like actually, you know, sending a bad update to a device or something, between that and targeted monitoring, which might be, say TikTok wants to monitor a specific user, and also the concerns around the bulk monitoring and bulk collection from all TikTok users. So you've made the distinction there. And also you've taken a look at influence operations that might be executed on TikTok as a platform. You've boiled it all down. And ultimately, I think you've arrived at the determination that the thing that should be the top priority, that is the top concern, is the influence op stuff.
Yeah. And what made me interested about that is I wrote about TikTok quite some while ago. And my skepticism is that it's never quite clear how you draw a straight line between influence and achieving a political objective for the Chinese Communist Party, which is what people are worried about. And since then, there have been a number of articles and evidence that TikTok is just tremendously influential. So in the last week, there was an indictment, a Russian group had been promoting a pirate ebook site. And it turns out that one of the ways that that site was getting traction was on TikTok. People were promoting it on TikTok. That didn't actually have anything to do with the runners, the people organizing the ebook site, but I thought that was interesting. There's also evidence that TikTok can make or break movies. So the Minions movie that became tremendously popular, it's in the top 50 odd movies of all time.
I mean, I think you established that it can make movies. I don't think you've established that it can break them. But certainly you've established that, you know, that movie was essentially a hit because of TikTok.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of an additive thing, right? You can't take a bad movie and make it good. I think you can take a moderate movie and it's influential enough to make it a laughing stock. And you can take a good movie and really promote it. So I think it does make a difference. And so given that it does make a difference, what do you do about it? It seems to me that the steps you take to mitigate that are just more opaque than, say, in comparison, trying to manage user data access.
Yeah, I mean, this is really at the core of your piece, which is you're saying, okay, there's concerns around ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company. There are concerns around its ability to access data on, like, American users, right? And TikTok has stood up, or ByteDance has stood up, a project called Project Texas, which is about trying to put US user data into data centers in the United States. Now, while you are skeptical that this project can be 100% successful, you make the point that at least it's something where they can make a ding. And also something where they can be seen to be trying. Whereas when it comes to influence ops, it's going to be very difficult for them to prove the negative, because auditing the algorithm that determines these, you know, the way that content spreads on TikTok outside of human curation, auditing, you know, a machine learning based system like that is actually notoriously difficult. So this is the real bind for TikTok. So it's a bind for policymakers because they don't really have any visibility if that's happening. And it's a bind for TikTok because they can't really show that it's not happening, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to be clear, we don't know exactly what the algorithm within TikTok looks like.
we don't truly know how influential it is either, because there's a lot of human curation involved in what you see on TikTok.
Yeah, that's right. But I've not heard of anywhere else algorithms at the heart of social media companies being audited for any purpose whatsoever. So it seems to me At first glance, I've got doubts that it'll, you know, we'll read, that we'll see an auditor's report and we'll be convinced by it, I guess. And that's the fundamental problem. And in contrast, when you look, if there was an auditor's report saying, here's what they've done to lock down data access, I would be able to understand it enough to have some confidence or not that it was working. And you'd be sort of left with a, well, they've done these things. I think that's maybe enough. That's an acceptable risk. Whereas I think the element of doubt when it comes to an algorithm will be a lot higher. And I think that that, even a comprehensive auditor's report won't make doubts go away. And as TikTok gets bigger and more influential, those fears will just rise. And I don't think TikTok will be able to mitigate them.
Yeah, and you make the point that it's a conversation that they are taking, they're at great pains to avoid, right? Like they don't get into any of this We Are the Town Square chit-chat, which kind of makes sense as well because they're more a broadcasting company than they are a Twitter or whatnot. One other interesting thing that you included this article were some comments from FBI Director Christopher Wray, who I believe was speaking in a, was it a congressional hearing last week?
House Homeland Security Committee hearing.
Yeah, there we go. And, you know, he said that there were concerns that, you know, TikTok could push bad updates and, you know, compromised devices and stuff. I mean, sure, maybe. But this is the sort of thing that if they were to do that, they'd probably get caught if they did it in a major way. And it's not like pushing updates. Like the concern about bad updates in something like the Huawei situation was that, you know, the company could push a bad update that would affect the availability of a 5G network during a war or something like that. That was the concern. Whereas pushing some bad updates to phones that someone is probably going to notice doesn't strike me as being a, I mean, sure, it could happen, but it doesn't strike me as being a noteworthy risk. And you neither, as it turns out.
Yeah, exactly right. It just seems, you know, there's, first of all, there's app stores in the middle that have some opportunity to review things.
I actually got in contact with Mark Dowd to ask him just quickly about that. And he was like, well, maybe on Android you could get it to allocate some memory, something. But, you know, he was obviously doing something else. But I had a quick chat to him about that. And he seemed more or less on the same page as us, which is it would be difficult to do it in a way that wouldn't be noticed. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think also it's a much easier risk to mitigate. So already many government departments and defense departments say you shouldn't use TikTok on your government device.
Yeah.
And you know, you can mitigate it for particular people. If something bad does happen and the worst case is it bricks phones, it's a lot easier to replace a phone than it is to replace, you know, for example, a 5G network.
Yeah.
So I just think that's, to me, it doesn't really make sense. It's kind of a bit worrying that he mentions it in that sort of committee.
Yeah, you sort of wonder what he's seen, right? Like, there's always that part of it where, it's something Adam and I joke about on the show quite often, is when the cybersecurity directorate at NSA issues a warning about a particular technique or something, it's always like, you know, you always get a little bit tense reading them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I think also the business driver for Huawei, not for Huawei, the business driver for TikTok is to become more powerful. Powerful is the wrong word, more influential. That's what they're trying to do. But this makes it, I think, more difficult for them.
Exactly. I mean, the whole point here is as they succeed, you know, people get more worried, right?
Yeah,
so it's like a reverse incentive for success. One thing when I've been discussing this issue with other people, right? Like, you know, we're recording this, you know, the morning in Australia after, was it last night our time, you know, Elon Musk was sort of promoting and engaging with some fairly notorious fascists with some pretty strange ideas on Twitter. And, you know, you've got outlets and broadcasters in the United States where all this is happening, that platform people like, you know, Tucker Carlson, who spews a bunch of really cooked stuff, let's be honest, right? So I guess the question is, like, how much of a concern is it that TikTok might be doing some influence campaigns, which you would think people are going to notice, right? You would hope someone would notice. How much of a concern is that when the information environment in the United States is so cooked already, basically, is the question.
I think it's like, at least TikTok is something that you can do something about. And the way I think about it is that there's a difference between citizens and non-citizens. So in terms of the US information environment, Elon has a ticket to play because he's a citizen, right? And so he's got a valid ability to say stuff. Now, I actually think it's terrible that some of those companies are essentially run by just individuals who could have all sorts of weird ideas and be actually bad for society. But I think that that's something that that society has to figure out through regulation and laws. Whereas I think that when it comes to having a company controlled by an outside party, they don't have that that ticket. They don't get to have a say. And if you're concerned about them being deliberately malicious, which I think there's valid reasons to be concerned about the Communist Party, then I think you should do something about it. That's not to say that you shouldn't do something about the regulation of social media in your own country as well.
Well, that's a whole other topic and a very, very complicated one that I have mixed feelings about as a publisher. But anyway, That was actually a surprisingly good answer to that one, Tom. I'm impressed.
And that's what I'm here for, Patrick.
that was very interesting. Thank you. So the other thing that you covered, and it's something that we actually covered in the main show yesterday, which is this executive order that's coming on spyware. What's great about this is I read yours. You'd written this before we recorded yesterday's show, and I hadn't seen this, and you and I are as one on this, which is it looks like the executive order that's coming from the Biden White House on the way it's going to treat companies that make commercial spyware, it looks pretty sensible. It actually looks pretty good, which is, I mean, I suppose cyber regulations just keep getting better as it becomes an area of policy that's better understood. But it's still heartening, isn't it, when you see that, oh, okay, they've got this. They seem to have their heads around it. That was my impression. It seemed to be yours as well.
Yeah, so last week, the Gruck and I spoke about some recommendations from a European investigation into Pegasus and spyware.
Yeah, that's the EU Parliament investigation, right?
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, the PEGA report. That's
the one. Yep. Yeah. And some of the recommendations were just kind of seem to me to be based on the idea that we just hate the concept of spyware.
Yeah.
And
whereas us in the Five Eyes, in the free Five Eyes world, Tom, we love it. We love the stuff when it's used correctly, right?
Well, I think you can, like, you know, you can have different philosophical positions. And I think that you can have dual use, right? You can take advantage of the good stuff and try and get rid of the bad stuff. And so the problem with those recommendations were that they were maybe this is too strong, but they were outrage-based. And what I really liked about this is that so the reporting was based on a letter that was sent to the House Intelligence Committee based on some questions. And it just really clearly articulates what the different issues are. And so, you know, proliferation, human rights abuses, counterintelligence, and a couple other things. And when you clearly pull out what the issues are, it's much, much easier to say what the response is.
Yeah.
And there's different responses for each of those separate issues. So I think
it's, I mean, when you read that letter that you're talking about, which came from what? It was the
State Department and Commerce, the Departments of State and Commerce.
Yeah, Department of Commerce, which handles the, you know, export regulation bits, doesn't it? And yeah, anyway, it was just good. Like you read through it and you're like, oh, okay, they've clearly done the work here. But you're right too. And the strange thing about that EU PEGA report is there was so much good information in it.
Yep.
And then some knee-jerk sort of emotion-based recommendations, but you know, such a mixed bag. Whereas this is really outcomes-based, really pragmatic. You know, how do we harness the benefit of some private sector innovation in the space to, you know, do better policing and intelligence collection while making sure that, you know, people aren't going to get, you know, summarily executed or tortured as a result of this technology being used by the wrong people. So, you know, it seems to strike a pretty good balance.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So one more thing that we're going to talk about this week, which is you've just squeezed it into a short item in the newsletter. It was something that we just did not have space to cover in yesterday's show. And that's that the so-called NSPM 13 rule in the United States, which governs the circumstances under which US Cyber Command can actually do a thing. Those rules have been tweaked. And it looks like they've done the sensible thing here, because for a while it looked like the State Department wanted to get, you know, essentially veto power over cybercom ops, which seemed a little bit insane to me. But that said, it's still good if the State Department knows what cybercom's up to. And that's where they landed, which is cybercom now is required to notify the State Department when they're going to do a thing. And, you know, I think for a whole of government, from a whole of government perspective, that's a rule that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so I wrote about the news that this was going to be examined quite some months ago, and the framing at the time was that it would rein back authorities that had been given under the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And the sort of, I spoke to Bobby Chesney at the time, and the take was, look, probably, I mean, we don't know because it's classified. There are probably good reasons why you would want to review it and just make sure it's good. There might be some tweaks around the edges that would actually make it, I guess, better is the right word to use, in that it's a better balancing of the different interests of different parts of government. And that seems to be what has happened. What I thought was interesting is towards the end of the CyberScoop report, it talks about, it quotes a senior administration official who says that Cyber Command has been able to notch a bunch of good wins, justifying the argument that having more flexibility and being able to move faster really does help operations. So that's kind
of... Yeah, so that's an interesting signal that they put some runs on the board, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And to me, there's... if you're doing cyber operations right, they don't become diplomatic incidents. And that's really... to me, I think the risk that the State Department is trying to mitigate. And
well, I think knowing is the important bit, which is why I think that instead of a veto power, they just get to know, you know, because knowing is important if you're a diplomat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like I said, I think there's good reasons to sort of adjust that process. It's kind of sounded like that the Department of Defense would previously could just run it and essentially do whatever they liked. I don't think that that's true, but that's kind of the way it was framed. So it seemed like a pretty sensible outcome justified by success.
Yeah. I mean, even if the DOD can do stuff unilaterally, they still have their own lawyers, right? And they'll always have something to say. So, you know, there's that's something to keep in mind. You just mentioned Bobby Chesney, who's the Dean of Law at UT Austin these days. Funnily enough, there's a book about the lead up to 9/11. Called The Looming Tower. And there's a composite character in there. The book apparently was written by a friend of Bobby's, and there's a composite character written into it who's named Bobby Chesney. He's an FBI agent. And I tell you what, I got a hell of a shock because I started watching that show because there was a TV adaptation that was actually quite good, and I started watching it last year. And at one point where they introduced the character Bobby Chesney, it was a somewhat surreal moment. Tom Uren, thank you so much for joining me to talk through this week's fabulous edition of Seriously Risky Business. A pleasure as always, my friend.
Thanks, Pat.